If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey there, everybody. Welcome to Rough Draft. I'm your host, Reza Aslan. Our guest on the pod today is screenwriter Melissa Rosenberg. She's perhaps best known as the creator of Marvel's Jessica Jones series, and she also wrote every one of those Twilight movies that you pretend you don't love. One of the things that I love about Melissa is that she has really mastered the art of writing a strong, iconic female protagonist, which, listen, writers, is not the easiest thing to do. You know, it's very tricky terrain. You have to create a character that is pretty, not too pretty, smart, not too smart, you know, strong, not too strong, still gotta fall in love with a guy, of course, somewhere in the story. And yet, Melissa has managed, not just with Bella in the Twilight series, but with Jessica Jones, to create female protagonists that are memorable, that are strong, that are powerful, and yet also at the same time, feminine. And one of the things that we talk about in our conversation is, what is the process to creating that kind of female protagonist? She's also a woman in Hollywood, a obviously male-dominated industry, and she's got some incredible stories, both pre and post Me Too, about what that experience has been like and how she's managed to overcome it and still succeed. And, you know, maybe we'll even talk a little bit about her father, Dr. Orgasm, which will make a lot more sense in the conversation itself. Without further ado, here is my conversation with screenwriter and TV writer Melissa Rosenberg. I have wanted to meet you for so long. I'm such a fan of yours, and I just love sort of your career trajectory. I want to talk about so many different things. But first, let's begin by just congratulating you on a successful completion of Jessica Jones.
Thank you.
That must feel good. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm curious, like, did you tell the story you wanted to tell? Did it end the way that you wanted to end? You had three seasons.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely got to tell the story I wanted to tell. There's a world in which it could have gone on for
seven years, eight, nine.
Well, I'm gonna say two, maybe. But I was actually ready to move on, and so it ended up working out really well. So
yeah.
I think three is a really complete story over the course of three seasons.
And you felt like you were able to close it out in an emotionally satisfying way, really say what you wanted to say with that character.
Yeah, I felt that way.
Yeah, that's great. And so what's next for you now?
I have the great privilege of adapting an Alice Hoffman novel, the prequel to her novel, Practical Magic.
No kidding.
Yeah, it's called Rules of Magic. And it's taking two characters from Practical Magic who are elderly and they're in that and setting it in 1960s in New York when they're teenagers.
So adaptation seems to be kind of a thing for you. I mean, is that...
Completely.
Did you slip into it, or is that something that you've always kind of gravitated towards?
Yeah, it's funny. To me, the original screenplay, the original storytelling is the hardest possible thing, coming out of thin air, inventing, and to me that's sort of the highest achievement. And so my whole career I've been trying to have that, you know, striving toward that. But where I found that I if I shine anywhere, it's going to be in playing in other people's sandboxes and building the castles out with their tools and their sand. And, you know, sort of Charlie Kaufman versus Steve Zaillian. And, you know, I think both have done extraordinary work. I just sort of tend to, not that I'm far cry from Steve Zaillian, but, you know, it's a way of collaborating with another writer, whether or not you meet that person or not. It's a way of playing in there with another writer's storytelling.
But doesn't it also come with some pitfalls, though?
I mean,
especially when you're talking about Alice Hoffman, or as we talk about in a little while, the Twilight saga. You know, those are books that people have a lot of emotional investment in. And then somebody hands it over to you, and you can't just simply transfer what's on the page to a screen. That's not how adaptation works, obviously.
Well, that to a tween girl.
Exactly. I was going to say,
come at you with a pitchfork,
right,
man.
Right. That's not how I imagined it.
Yeah.
So what do you do with those pitfalls? I mean, do you just ignore it? Do you just simply say, it's my story? I mean, there's a property that I have, that there's a world that's already created and characters that I love. And obviously, I'm going to follow the plot line and more or less, but I have to put this into three acts, and I have to make it interesting, and I have to make it, 90 minutes.
Right.
Or 4.5 hours if it's a Marvel movie.
Right.
Do you relish that challenge, or do you ever feel like, oh, I don't know if I want to step into something like that again?
Both. For me, there's something that comes along with a really popular title. Or in Jessica Jones' case, it was, she was probably the lesser known of Marvel superheroes, but
still a comic book.
You get that Marvel title right on that front
right.
title page, and you've got an audience.
Yeah.
And there is something to be said for a built-in audience, because we write so people can either read us or watch us, and too many movies and television shows don't get seen and don't get the stories aren't heard. Because, there's so much. So that was the beauty of both, Jessica Jones and Twilight. That's really, they show up. Then you go to the other side. They show up with expectations. In the case of Jessica
Jones.
Loud
expectations.
Loud expectations. In the case of Jessica Jones, again, because she wasn't that popular, actually it was kind of fantastic. And I was working with such an amazing original book by Brian Michael Bendis and Michael Gatiss. Mm-hmm. And it was, that book is, that graphic novel is, that character's so rich.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So all I had to do was stay true to the character, which is why I wanted to do it in the first place, is to write that character. And I think fans and the audience really could root for it.
It worked out well.
It worked out well. For me, it did. I'm really happy. For Twilight, what I really learned over the course of doing five of those guys is if you take the audience on the same emotional journey that the book takes them on, I feel like in my mind that's mm-hmm. the way to appease the audience. Now there's a whole slew of girls out there on the internet and happy to point out all the ways in which I didn't satisfy them at all. But that was my objective, to just tell the story. What is their emotional arc? Finding the plot points that move that forward, move those characters forward, and then either filling in or, editing, combining, condensing.
Well, I want to talk a lot more about this, but I want to talk about your childhood a little bit. You grew up in Marin, right? Okay. In Marin County, to hippie parents, right?
It's funny. They were sort of between straightforward hippies and they're more me generation, the
Mippies.
70s. Mippies, I assume they're called. So they were all kind of coming into puberty at the same time we were. And it was a very, it was a rocky world, very unsettled and very not particularly safe place to grow up.
How so? How was it not safe?
They were really involved in their own lives.
Oh.
And they were divorced and kind of went off and did their thing. And there was four of us kids, and we're kind of, raised by wolves, if you will. And, there's a lot you get from that, which is a freedom to, and we very much encouraged even by them, to really find who we were, what our voice was, and to really take risks and not ever settle for, the usual.
Did you shuttle back and forth between the two parents?
Yeah. Dad had his groove pad on, houseboat in Sausalito. I mean.
So let's talk about Dad for a minute. I don't know. I mean, I don't know if people here know about Jack Lee Rosenberg. He's a quite an accomplished psychotherapist, I guess. Is that what we would say? famous for a lot of work. My favorite book of his, of course, is Total Orgasm, which also, by the way, happens to be my wife's nickname for me. I just think, you know, this sounds weird, but like, you know, as I'm sitting here thinking about you and your life, and I'm wondering, like, what is it like to be the child of a father who writes Total Orgasm?
The daughter, the daughter of Mr. T.O.
That's, yeah.
Yeah.
He did a lot of other things, by the way, I should mention. He is very much into mind, body, and, you know.
Yeah, the, sexuality was a big part of his work.
Sure. And,
you know, it's, I was coming into my own sexuality at the same time, so it was pretty, that talk about unsafe, in a way, you know.
Yes.
It was, there was no very, boundaries were very unclear. So it was an interesting time to be a teenager.
Do you think it affected not just how you see the world, obviously, but also how you construct worlds in your writing?
Yeah, in both positively, and negatively in some ways, but in a positive way. Of I didn't grow up in a traditional home, in a traditional world, and so. If I'm trying to write a traditional world, this is a big problem. I got to get someone in there who actually had, you know. There was one point in my life, I was just starting out here, and I was working in an office. And the guy next to me was saying, you know, his wife had just had a baby, and her mom went and left a chicken for her in the fridge. And I was like, moms do that? You know, there's a chicken. And it occurred, it was like this kind of odd moment of like, wow. That's what it would be like to have, you know, parents who actually, I mean, it seems, you know, but this was not something my
This is actually
did.
Really fascinating, and I never really realized it until this moment, which is that there is always that undercurrent of, danger is the wrong word, because obviously you're talking about people who are hanging out with, like, vampires and werewolves.
Right.
That seems to be a little dangerous, and, like, serial killers and, you know, superheroes. But what I mean is, a lack of security. Hmm. Does that make sense? Like this undercurrent in which your characters, your protagonists especially, is never stable exactly, never secure exactly. Are you drawn to those kinds of stories because of the kind of childhood that you had?
I think maybe. It's a character that I know. It's a if I were asked to write the story of the really stable character who went off into the world and became unstable, I wouldn't know how to do that.
Yeah.
But a person who comes from an unsafe world, who feels unstable and insecure, and then makes their own, comes into their courage, finds their own voice, that to me is, that's my favorite theme, that's my favorite character, and always trying to find that.
So you graduated from high school.
Yeah.
And then you go off to be a dancer in, I guess, New Jersey?
Yeah, I was working with a little theater and dance company. We were initially in New Jersey, and then moved up to New York. It was kind of a weird little theater and dance company. It was led by a sort of a shaman, a woman.
Okay. I like this already.
Not American Indian, but she, it was like this, we did theater and dance, improv theater and dance in a sort of therapy, theater and dance therapy.
Yeah, and you're sure it wasn't a cult?
I'm pretty sure.
So like now that you're thinking about it, you're like, wait a second.
I think some people might consider it a cult, but I didn't have to do anything there. No, all I had to do was like actually perform and, you know, play music and we did a lot of workshops and teaching all around. So it was an introduction to me to theater in a sort of odd way. Coming from where I come from, it was perfectly normal, you know. My father taught at Esalen and Big Sur for up until he died.
I'm going to just sort of admit something here because this question is a little bit awkward for me. I like to think of myself as woke.
I don't know.
Semi-woke. One of our producers mentioned that the way that you paid for that was by, and this is how it was put to me, working the strip club circuit. And I was like, what, like, as a, like, serving drinks? I don't know, what is that? Cleaning the floors? Can I ask about that without being that guy? Can I ask about, can I, is that okay?
Absolutely.
All right.
I'm pretty out about it.
No, we're talking about women, we're talking about feminism. I don't want to, you know.
No, it's another real education in life. And it was, I'm actually not even close to the first screenwriter or television writer who has that background.
I mean, oh, you know,
Diablo
not.
Came out about it.
Yeah, absolutely.
My
yeah.
partner on Jessica Jones, Ryle Tucker, is very open about it. And this is a way in which women can make money. Mm-hmm. And there are some other people in this theater and dance company that were doing that. And I was like, sure. But it was so lame because, you know, I would go walk the stage and you're talking about like really, you know, kind of mm-hmm. gritty bars in New Jersey. These guys are coming in for lunch for a, you know, couple of six beers. And
the guy at lunch, that's honestly the most depressing thing. Like the guy is like, I've got a 45-minute lunch break. Where's the nearest strip club?
Yeah, seriously. And I was not, you know, clearly not the big star to go on Friday or Saturday night, although I did those too. But, and
you were doing the Tuesday afternoon.
I was doing the shift, yeah. the morning mm-hmm. shift, which is very sad. But I was like, you know, into doing my modern dance. And I was just, and I turn on something, and I like really get into the music. I just sing, and, you know, and stop. I look up and they'd be like,
what is happening?
What? You know, so I was not. I didn't make as much money as a lot of people have made in that profession.
No, look. I ask these questions honestly because when I look at Jessica Jones, one of the most striking aspects of it is how frankly it deals with sex and female sexuality, but then at the same time, it refuses to sexualize Jessica or Trisha. It refuses to sexualize really any of the female characters, but it does have sex and there's, you know, sexualities in it. And I'm just curious how much of that, which is a unique trait in a show like that, how much of that has to do with growing up with Dr. Total Orgasm and then yes, Mr. I apologize, Mr. Dr. Rosenberg. And then also your experiences, you know, in the strip club. I mean, how much of that influenced how you tackle issues of sexuality when you're dealing with these incredibly strong, empowered women?
Well, it was a really interesting process to... I was very young when I was doing it, and so... And there was a very sort of, it took a long time and a lot of different wokes along the process. Mm-hmm. And it was interesting, my partner on season two of Jessica Jones, Ryle Tucker, who I mentioned before, mm-hmm. she and I have a very, very similar background. And I would come to it where I'd have a character like Trish, for instance, who in her youth was a child star and who just kind of segued into drugs, alcohol, and sex mm-hmm. and just kind of only saw herself as valuable because of that.
Right.
And I was really coming from kind of a dark, slightly judgmental place. And Ray had to completely, Ryle is her name, I call her Ray, I had a completely different take on it. She's like, well, you know, this isn't about shaming women with their sexuality. We want them to embrace their sexuality and, you know.
And on their own
terms. So it's always been this sort of battle for me internally in terms of at what point does someone who owns their sexuality and who is you know, free in that regard tip over into someone who feels that the only thing they have of value is that. Mm. And it was a very conscious choice with Jessica, just out of sheer boredom with other, having been a TV viewer for many, many years. Every time you have anytime you have any kind of a crime show or some sort of detective, it is without a doubt, if she's a woman, there's going to be a time where she goes undercover in a tight little black dress and you know, every single
yeah.
person.
Right.
And if it's not her, someone else has to go undercover as the hooker or whatever. And I was like, one, it's just simply not Jessica's character to do that. She just in a million years wouldn't do that. She just soon break someone's face. And two, it's just sort of like, well, that's not the story we're telling. You know, this is a very, very conscious choice not to do that.
You know, as you were talking about that, I was thinking that also applies really well in the way in which the show dealt with sexual violence.
Mm-hmm.
you know, rape was a conversation that happened a lot throughout that first season, but you never saw the action itself. What you saw was the aftermath, mm-hmm. right? You saw characters dealing with the aftermath of that. And then obviously, am I ruining this show for people who have never seen it?
Well,
too bad. Too bad. Yeah. Fuck you guys. Okay? Too late.
Haven't seen
too late.
It. You blur.
But the fact that the sexual violence came through this incredibly complex supernatural experience of having someone control her mind and control her will, and there were these constant conversations about, but did you want it or did you not want it? Mm. I felt like what I was witnessing was the kinds of conversations that you see on college campuses or in the media, but wrapped up in this kind of science fiction fantasy version of that. How cognizant were you guys in the room when you were dealing with that particular storyline of the way in which you were treating issues of rape and the survival of sexual violence without necessarily doing what you were talking about earlier, right? The CBS procedural, right? Where it's like every fucking episode is about a rape or some, you know, terrible thing that happens to a woman.
Yeah, the first thing is open on a half-naked woman with her underwear around her ankle.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Every single one.
Yeah, 9 p.m. on a Sunday. Thank you.
Yeah. I know, it's crazy.
But just don't swear.
Yeah.
Yeah. So as long as you don't swear, it's fine.
Yeah, you can have, you can gut people and...
Yeah, you can do whatever you want.
Sidebar, Dexter, at one point during the writer's strike, went from Showtime and aired on CBS. And everyone's like, oh, can you do that? Can you put it? And I was like, that is so much more tame than anything. Just take out the language.
Yeah.
It's so much more tame than anything
absolutely.
On like,
absolutely.
CSI or whatever they are. I'm like, my goodness. Anyway, I forgot.
I took you off track. Question of, sexual violence and the way that you guys dealt with it.
You know, this was the character of Jessica Jones that came from the Alias comic book that Brian Michael Bendis wrote was someone who there's like one issue in which she'd had this sort of experience with the Purple Man or Kilgrave. And she wasn't even actually raped. Oddly, she was forced to watch rape. Mm. And we were just like, okay, we'll bypass that and just go with, you know, really making it visceral to her. And so that's what we started with that storyline. And we just came at it from a point of view of character. You know, if you're that character, if you're Jessica, what are you genuinely going through? What is the authentic experience? What is your authentic journey? And, you know, everyone in that room was a feminist. And so we're all cognizant of, you know, if we're tipping over the edge and mm-hmm. going to places that felt not right, but we weren't paying attention to it as an issue. We weren't paying attention to any, we weren't kind of trying to make a statement. It was before the whole Me Too thing happened. In fact, we came out at the same time as Me Too. We're like, everyone's going, oh, this is incredible that you foresaw this. Like, well, not really, because it's been happening for centuries and thousands of years. But so we never approached it from the point of view of let's tackle an mm-hmm. issue. It was really, what
story
is she
experience? Character.
Yeah. Story character. Yeah. She's, what is she, what would she be going through here?
Sure.
What's her experience? So it was, and then to turn around when it came out and everyone was writing these wonderful think pieces on what an incredibly political statement it was and on domestic violence and all this stuff. And I was like, well, yeah, we totally were trying to do that.
Yeah. Tiny.
Yes. but it was also the thing I was just, I felt like if it all ended at that moment, it would be fine because I'd contributed to the conversation. And, you know, my entire career, for all of us, you know, our entire career, did we move anything forward? Did we contribute mm-hmm. to the conversation? And that we had was just humbling. Yeah. And I mean, you have that experience all the time.
I mostly piss people off. That's I don't move anyone. I move people towards anger.
Well, you know what? That's the most valuable thing sometimes. But.
So let's go back to childhood. So you tried the dancing thing for a while, and then how did dancing become writing?
Well, I'm good enough. I think it's pretty much how that camp had to. Yeah, it's one of the things where I had always written and always loved to write. And as a kid, you know, grabbing my mom's typewriter to write the great American novel, and you know, that kind of thing. But I wanted to be a choreographer. And I was very, I loved dance, and I went to undergrad at Bennington in Vermont and studied choreography. And it was pretty clear, by the time I got to the end of it, it was really clear that I didn't think I was ever a good enough dancer or even choreographer to really shine, to really, you know, I would be good. I would have been good.
But you wanted to be great.
Well, you want to kind of feel all those sparks going. Mm-hmm. And there were so many other things I was interested in, like writing and politics and various things. And so I came out to LA and discovered that television and film was written.
Yeah, it's weird, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Didn't know.
We should tell the studios, too.
Yeah, we should. Yeah.
There's actually words first.
First, there are words. And once I kind of, because you think many, not these days, not so much, because the showrunner and writing is very much, here we are talking, and so someone's going, oh, wow, that was written. but I, didn't really have a concept of that. And
Around when was this? So
this was year-wise or age-wise?
Yeah, like decade-wise.
80s, mid-80s.
The 80s, okay.
Yeah, 80 through 90. 86 through 90, I was sort of, working as assistants to producers and writers and such, and saw what they did, and worked with the two writers who just lied on the couch and threw pencils at the ceiling tiles. And went, that's a great job.
Just
not
to be clear,
how hard it is.
Two male writers lying on the ground throwing pencils at the ceiling. So wasn't that just a little bit of an obstacle? Did you notice that? Did you notice that everyone around you had a penis?
Well, I didn't know. I didn't try not to think about that. although sometimes that was. They made that impossible. But, I worked for a female producer by the name of Bonnie Dorr, who's passed away since then. But and she was very much a part of women in film. And so I was working for the example of someone who was in the industry and who made her bones and got to do what she wanted to do. And there were other examples out there, few and far between, but, there was Winnie Hulseman, who was doing My So-Called Life and who I was just, idolized. And there's a few around. But really it was just about this. I was so obsessed with storytelling. I was so hungry to do that I didn't give it a lot of thought. I just kind of barreled in and,
But I wonder, you must have had, In those days especially, some pretty uncomfortable experiences in those writer rooms, having to just kind of deal with the... By the way, I love how I'm talking about this like it's in the past. I was about to say, to those days in which you had to deal with the male-dominated culture of Hollywood. Remember those days?
Well, that's my show now, so.
Anyway, yeah, exactly. Now you run the shit.
Now,
exactly.
Yeah, that shit on me.
But I'm curious back then, what that experience was like. Did you feel like, I'm just going to have to just kind of eat this for now, because what am I going to do? Complain?
Yeah, it was not quite so conscious as that. It was just kind of, plowing through, trying to do things. And, I got fired a lot. I've got fired a lot, either in... some of the times I would blame it on, well, they just don't like women, And I was like, in retrospect, no, I just wasn't very good on the show. Yeah. And in some cases it was just, us not blending. And my not understanding the culture. So there was many different reasons. Mm-hmm. I forgot the question now. I just went back.
It was just
PTSD.
Generally how shitty men in writer's room are. It wasn't
not
even a question.
All.
It was just like a statement.
It's so not just not true at all. I think, I learned the most from so many wonderful men. I've had so many great relationships, friendships, creative partnerships with men. I've got this couple of them over there who are in our writer's room right now. It's really been... my honor. There is a maleness that, when they're dominating the room, you just have to kind of adjust. And I never really figured out how to adjust. It was like, should I just be a fly on the wall, or should I be like one of the guys, or should I defend my gender? And I never figured it out. I've tried all three, and it was like the only way to get worked out as to be the boss.
That's what I was just gonna say. I was like, I got a fourth option. Why don't I just run this shit myself?
Exactly.
And that's what happened. So, yeah. I mean, you had
some, it took a long time.
Yeah, I don't wanna make light of the fact that you worked your ass off there, but you just had sort of back-to-back successes, obviously with Dexter, one of the great shows, a show that made it so that my wife couldn't sleep for months and months.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, it's your fault. And then Step Up, you did a movie about dancing. That must have felt good.
That was, what was so amazing about that is my very first job in Hollywood was I'd gotten hired to rewrite a dance movie, my Paramount. And the reason I got hired was because of my dance background. And so I had had this painful, like having to, you know, give up my dream of being a choreographer.
Yeah.
But then the first job I ever got was because I had a dance background. Now that movie never got made, but 12 years later, I got Step Up. And so my first movie that ever got made was because I was a dancer.
Right.
And I met with Ann Fletcher, who was also a dancer. She was the director and just spoke the same language. And you know, so it all comes around. So what I love about what we do is there's no wasted time.
Yeah.
Every experience goes on to the page.
Yeah, I mean, the creative process starts here. Yeah. And so this is what you have to develop, right?
Yeah.
So from there, you're given this tiny movie about this book that no one's ever heard of before called Twilight. Like, what happened there? By the way, that's amazing enough, but you'd mentioned this earlier, and I think it just kind of got lost a little bit. You wrote all five Twilight movies, which I don't think people understand how unusual that is. That doesn't happen in film, you know? I mean, that's to write the entirety of an epic saga like that is extraordinary. So, well done, first of all.
Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, that just doesn't happen. That doesn't happen. You like bring in a new writer every time, you know? Yeah. It's not like the same person wrote every Harry Potter movie. That's not how it works.
All but one.
Wait, is that right?
Yeah.
Oh, then let's just edit out this entire... let's just forget this entire conversation. I'm just kidding. Tell us about that. How did that come to you?
Well, I had done Step Up, and Summit was the studio, and we had just a great experience together. And it was a really good partnership, particularly with Eric Feig, who was the head of the development.
Great guy.
I don't remember his title, probably president, I think was his title at that point. And it was just a really good creative partnership. So a few months went by, they offered me Step Up 2. And they said it was going to go, it's just a straight to video thing. And I'm like, it's not like it's a continuing storyline. I'm not going to write it better the second time. And straight to video, I don't know. Didn't mention that. Oh, later it became an actual release, a wide release.
19 movies, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But it was okay because then I thought, and they were really mad. And I was like, oh, shit, I just fucked up my entire relationship with them. I'm never working in this town again. But then a few months went by and Eric called me. He's like, well, how do you feel about teens and vampires? And I was like, I
love both.
I said, I love it because, I mean, I think one of the great, great series of all time is Buffy.
Yes, absolutely.
I mean, one of the great, great series.
Yes. And I don't mean to be crass, but Twilight's not Buffy.
No,
I mean,
it's not.
You familiar with the books?
No, I wasn't that much, but all I heard was teens and vampires, and I'm like, cool.
Yeah.
And I happened to be at a friend's house on that precise night, and he had the book, and so I went home and read it. And I was like, you know, regardless of how you feel about the writing in the book, Stephanie Meyer is an amazing storyteller. Mm-hmm. You know, she has a mythology of her world that is so intricately thought up. You know, when I was writing these things, I could call her and I say, what color wolf is, you know, blah de blah, and she, well, he's brown, and then the other guy is gray with a little brown paws, and then you say, well, what about this Volturi, third Volturi on the left? Well, that vampire 800 years ago had yogurt with his granola or whatever it is.
Right.
I mean, she had, it was just a, talk about a sandbox to play in, and I loved the mythology. So it was just a really good, and again, that was Eric Feig and the team over at Summit, and you know, it was just a really good marriage.
Did you have any idea what you were stepping into?
No, I did. I heard that the book had been kind of popular. Yeah. There was like
apparently
some
people
online,
liked it, I guess.
There's some online activity, some, yeah. And I was like, oh, I'll go look at it.
Somewhat
I got
interested in it. Yeah,
I went on to like some website and I saw just a hint of what it was, or you know, because it was scary, and I just didn't want to think about that. So I didn't look at anything on the web. I didn't read any of the following books. I was just, I want to immerse myself in this book and in this moment with myself and collaborating, you know, just on the page with Stephanie. And then it turned out to what it was. It was mind-blowing.
Wild ride.
It was wild ride. The most significant thing I remember moment was Twilight had not yet come out. But they're taking clips of it down to Comic-Con. And they had Hall H, which is the big, you know, Mondo, huge hall. And I walked in, and there were, I don't know how many people that hall holds, but like, I would say 5,000-6,000, something like that, right? I walked into 5,000 or 6,000, like, women and girls.
Yeah.
And I was looking around going, oh, fuck. I changed that scene. It's different than it was in the book.
Oh, no, what are they going to do to me?
Come out. Yeah. And so I kind of was sneaking. I had a seat up with the producers in the audience. And I, you know, I was walking down. This little girl comes up. She's like 12 or something. She wants me to sign her book. I'm like, she's like, I know who you are. I was like, fuck. They're going to come after me. I was having a freaking anxiety attack. I was sorry.
It's not. I mean, those girls are very serious about that.
Really
book.
Serious.
Really serious.
And then when the cast, Stephanie and Catherine Hardwicke, who directed the first movie, and the cast came out, it was so extraordinary because no one knew who they were.
Oh,
all
right.
They
That's
knew
true. At the time. They were basically unknown actors.
The movie hadn't even been out, but they were playing these people, the audience's favorite characters, and they walked out and there was this screaming swell. I mean, you know, the Beatles on Ed Sullivan, nothing on what was going here, you know? And you could see the energy and the yell just kind of like rebound off the actors. They kind of step back with this sort of, holy shit, this is, and that was the moment that their lives changed. I mean, I don't know, I didn't ask them, but it seemed like that was the moment they and I think, you know, Kristen Stewart and Rob Pattinson, they didn't seem to know how to respond. But that was when Taylor Lautner, that dude, he was so comfortable with the publicity, and he just got in there, was telling jokes and stuff. And
took his shirt off.
That was really all I had to do.
Yeah.
But, you know, again, no one knew who these kids were. And
I love the fact that you're sitting there with like 6,000 screaming tweens.
Well, and women too. It was not
women.
Just, it was
true.
Like half and half.
True. Hey, no, I don't mean to make fun of this. I mean,
no, absolutely.
But I love how, you know, you're in this room with like 5,000 screaming people and you think to yourself, I'm going to do 4 more of these.
I didn't know that at that time. No, actually, I did. I was already writing. They had hired me to write 2 and 3 before we even released the first movie. So, and then the 4th and 5th one were based on this one book, you know, the last book. And I didn't know at that time if I was going to do 4 and 5, because the 4th book in the series, Breaking Dawn, is such there's a very anti-choice message in it, which, you know, that is Stephanie's point of view, and I respect that. Mm-hmm. That's fine. It's her book, her story. But I couldn't write that story. I couldn't do. And so I was like, and I didn't know how to tell this story any other way. This is when Bella is miraculously impregnated. And in the book, she does not see it as, she does not see herself as having a choice. This baby simply must be born. And so it wasn't until I was talking to my sister-in-law, who's a former ACLU feminist attorney, who had read the books, oddly, and she said, you know, the way in, isn't it that deciding to have a child is a choice? Mm-hmm. And having not made that choice of my own, I'm child-free, you know, I was, like, that was a revelation to me. It seems very simple at the time, but, you know,
right.
I'm looking back and going, wait a minute, that's right, she's making a choice to have that child. And it didn't violate Stephanie's point of view, but it also validated my own. So it was, you know, that was always kind of the balance that I was writing with the Twilight stuff was you know, in the book, Bella's a very passive girl. She's and you can do that in a novel. You can have characters that are passive and reactive, and can't do that in a movie. Mm-hmm. So it was all about kind of shifting Bella into someone who is driving the story. And she is in reality. I mean, in the books, all the storytelling happens because Bella wants to have sex with Edward. It really boils down to exactly that.
That's pretty much it. Yeah.
It is. Bella wants to have sex with Edward, and that's why she does every... So-and-so's life is in danger, whoever gets murdered, and, you know, more vampires come. As long as she gets sex with Edward. So it was kind of, you know, it was really nice in the end, I ended up being able to find my way into four, and Stephanie and I had a really great meeting of the minds. And
so you talking about this, though, it brings up something very interesting, because at the same time that you're having this ridiculous experience of this sort of global phenomenon.
It's
crazy.
Yeah,
it must have been madness. I can't even imagine it. You're also dealing with this backlash, this sort of Bella hatred. Can I put it that way?
Sure.
I mean, people fucking hate her.
Yeah.
What is that all about? Like, we were talking about this earlier, that there was a Harvard professor who actually coined this idea of big Twilight bigotry. Is that what it
was? The bigotry of hating Twilight.
The bigotry of hating Twilight.
I think
I mean, the hatred is so extreme that it's a form of bigotry, apparently.
Well, the way she talked about it, the way she talked about it was, I mean, it was like, there are a lot of bad movies. Yeah, you know, people just don't like a movie. Like, you know, there was a Transformer somewhere down, you know, it was coming out around the same time as us. Yeah. And, you know, okay, maybe it's not.
That's good writing right there.
There you go. But, you know, it wasn't a great movie. People just said, yeah, kind of not a great movie, you know. But with Twilight, this is my theory, and was hers as well, because it is about a girl, it is about love, it is unapologetically mm-hmm. about love, which is typically seen as a chick flick, it was deserving of contempt. And the vitriol with which the critics, not all the critics, and they would have these like 60-year-old white guys reviewing it. It's like, dude, you're not the audience.
That's a good point.
And there's been a lot of talk currently about critics and, you know, why is this person reviewing that?
Yeah,
and,
right.
You know, so that conversation I noticed has been happening a lot in the
It's right amazing. Now. So I actually, just for fun, collected some of the critiques.
Oh God!
And by the way, I should mention, these are critiques of Bella in the book.
Yes.
Which I think you've said is a little bit different, a little more passive, but nevertheless the same character. And these are august institutions. Okay, so Publishers Weekly said about Bella, it's almost impossible to identify with her. Kirkus said that Bella's personality was, quote, flat and obsessive. Salon wrote of both Edward and Bella, quote, neither of them has much personality to speak of. National Review called Bella insufferably vain.
Mm.
And then I love this one.
Can't argue with that one.
I love this one. This is the Washington Post. They said, and they're talking about the problem that they have with Bella as a character. The overall effect is a weird infantilization that has repellent overtones to an adult reader and hardly seems like an admirable model to foist upon our daughters or sons.
Mm. Well, that's the book, right?
That's the book.
Yeah, got a lot of flack. I have nothing to do with the book. I think I approached the book with not a dissimilar feeling. I mean, I was worried about the character. I wanted to dig deeper into it. And I think that everything that I brought forward for her in terms of being proactive and driving a scene and being a strong directed young woman, I feel like it was all buried in the character, and I just chose to parse away all the other stuff. Mm. That's how I see it. And you know, there are people who have seen the movie who understand. Like, I was again down at Comic-Con, another one, and this young woman came up to me and saw this. She said, "I saw what you did there. I saw what you did." It's like, someone did. So, you know, I mean, I was just constantly writing that line of, this is Stephanie's story, this is her world, and I don't have any need or desire to attack that. Mm-hmm. But my world has to exist at the same time. And, you know, my own ethics and beliefs have to be able to exist in the same world. So it was, you know, we managed a bipartisan screenplay, I like to think.
Hey there, everyone. It's Reza. I'm sorry for the interruption. I just wanted to pop in and say that if you're enjoying this episode, well, then you're in luck, my friends, because Rough Draft is also a TV show, and you can watch it all right now, along with Topic's other original series and exclusive programming from around the world. You can check it out for free on the Apple TV app, which is already on your favorite devices. With Apple TV, you can watch Topic at home or on the go with offline viewing, and you can even share your subscription with up to 6 family members with family sharing, which is what I do because I have a gigantic family. Go to apple.co/topic to start your 7-day free trial now. That's apple.co/topic.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
This is actually a perfect bridge into a conversation about your craft. So let's talk about craft for a moment. You've become very well known for being able to construct these enormously complex female protagonists, which it is a very difficult thing to do because obviously, I don't need to tell you this, I don't need to tell anyone this, but we treat female protagonists far differently than we treat male protagonists. Male protagonists can have any flaw that they want to, you know? I mean, we actually celebrate those flaws. I mean, we're kind of over the anti-hero a little bit, but nevertheless, you know, we look at characters who have no redeeming qualities whatsoever, and we're like, I love that guy. but then you construct a female protagonist, and suddenly you're walking this knife edge. Suddenly it's like she's gotta be, you know, as I was talking about this at the top of the show, she's got to be just, you know, just smart enough. Not too smart. You don't want to make her too smart, but you don't want to make her dumb. You just want to make her just smart enough. You want to make her beautiful, not too beautiful. You want to make her vulnerable, but too vulnerable is not good enough, but not vulnerable enough that she's just a bitch. And, like, it's such a minefield to walk, and yet, you know, you've managed to construct, I think, two female protagonists that are gonna stand the test of time, that, you know, that people actually do, let's knock on something and some anything. that I think people look to in many ways as a model for how to do this. So I guess all of this is to say, what is the trick? Tell me, how do you do this? How do you make a strong but feminine female protagonist?
Does she have to be feminine?
I guess not. I mean, I don't know. That was weird that I said that, right? This is just, it.
There are people, both men and women, who are more feminine and, you know, and not.
What's the trick?
Don't write her as a woman. That's not her defining characteristic. When you write a man, do you say, I'm writing this man?
No.
No.
That's so true.
When you're writing a black man, you say, I'm writing a black man.
Right.
When you're writing a woman, you say you're writing a female character.
Mm-hmm.
When you're writing a white guy, you just say his name is Bob.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So it's like I think that has been the struggle that characters have dealt with, and actors trying to play them, is that everyone but the white guy is defined by their gender or their race or their orientation. And so that everything that comes out of their mouth is about that. That's not a character, you know? So if you strip away, a female character is certainly informed by her gender, and an African-American character is informed by his race and so on, but that is not a character.
Mm-hmm.
Like, oh, she's the woman, or she's the wife, or she's the, you know, sassy cop, you know? So it's that's how I've approached it, and it's been a really, that's been very important.
That's actually really, really good advice, to sort of just treat it as any character
it's
and not
character.
An archetype.
Yes.
Right.
It's a character.
What would you, so when you look at these sort of the two main sort of female protagonists that you're best known for, at least up till now, who knows what happens next, what do you think is the sort of the similarities and the differences between Bella and Jessica Jones? Like how do you see them in your mind? How do you differentiate them as characters, not according to their gender obviously, but just as characters? And what do you think is the through line between them?
Well, I mean, the difference is one, Jessica's funny. So, you know, and Kristen Ritter can deliver a dry line like nobody's
business.
Yeah,
she's pretty awesome.
I know, she's amazing. Not as much Kristen Stewart. Oh, they're both named Christians.
Oh.
There's the through line.
Weird, I just thought of that, yeah.
You know, I think Jessica's a much more flawed character and really fun to write for that reason, you know. And I think that was part of the trick with Bella was getting to those flaws. And I think that she is somewhat obsessive. Again, she wants Edward. She wants sex with Edward. And there is an element of selfishness to her. And even though she's constantly worried, I made all this happen. It's all my fault. I'm like, yeah. Yeah, it is. That's her flaw, is this sort of obsessive single-mindedness. Jessica is really damaged. She's a really damaged character, you know. And so is Bella, actually. I mean, she comes from a really, broken family, and a lot of what drives her toward Edward is it's a need for connection. Mm-hmm. And Jessica's, you know, she's just, the thing about Jessica, here's the other thing I learned about writing a female character. Sidebar. It's changed a lot, writing female characters. I mean, there was the very first series I ever showran and created was a series called Red Widow for ABC. And it had 8 episodes and out. And it's still, to this day, one of my favorite 8 episodes of anything, you know, that I've ever done. But it just no one tuned in. And I think part of that was marketing and advertising. The other part of it was that the lead character was a mother who was basically selling drugs. And at that time, it was, you know, sort of around when Tony Soprano and Walter White and Vic Mackey and all those great, anti-heroes were being told. But it wasn't, women had not yet gone there, flawed women. And it really wasn't until...
People didn't want to see that.
No one wants to. It was until like Weeds, Nurse Jackie,
right.
Orange, you know. And they were all because of Vic Mackey, Tony Soprano, you know, when you were able to have really flawed, damaged characters and audience, just slowly but surely audiences started coming around to that. So by the time I did Jessica, audiences, I had hoped, and fortunately they were, ready for a character like that. I don't think I could have done that. In fact, I tried with Red Widow and it just... And God forbid that this female character should be a mother. If your character back then was a mother...
Who wasn't perfect.
Forget
it.
You know, if she wasn't putting her children, like, every moment, then, you know, and, like, parents are flawed. Mothers are flawed. This woman, she's made some bad choices. But God forbid you should do that. I like to think that now,
Yeah,
a character could do that.
I think so.
Yeah.
So I was trying to figure out a way to help our audience truly understand, you know, the differences and the similarities between Jessica Jones and Bella Swan. And the only thing I could think of was to just do the whole Team Edward, Team Jacob. And so we're gonna play a little game. We're gonna play this little game that I like to call Team Bella or Team Jessica. It's very simple rules, very simple rules. I give you a historical female character, and then you just tell me, Team Bella, Team Jessica. Simple.
Okay.
Simple. Here we go.
I'm bad at history.
This is going to be great.
Okay.
Yeah. By the way, you can always feel free to say, I don't know who
no
that is.
No idea who that is.
I have no idea who that is. And then we'll just edit it out. No one knows.
And everyone will erase it from their minds.
Okay. Marie Curie.
I'm going to say Bella.
Team Bella?
Single-minded, directed.
Oh, very good. Very good. Meghan Markle.
I'm going to say Bella again.
Interesting. I kind of would have, all right.
She's an organized.
Okay, this one's tough. This one's tough. Malala.
I guess Jessica.
Maybe.
Just shake shit up.
It's kind of a superhero. Yeah, that's true. That's a good one. Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
You know, I have to say Bella again on that one. Because Jessica barrels into things and breaks faces. And Ruth just kind of went along and, you know, took one step after another and fucking made it happen.
That's good. So. That's a good one. I agree with you on that one. Okay, Margaret Thatcher.
Bella, but the less positive aspects.
Everything shitty about Bella. all right, here's one. Joan of Arc.
Jessica.
But,
you know, she's so like kind of in like self.
Tough. Maybe.
She's tough, but she's also a little kind of, you know.
And then last but not least, famous female historical figure, Donald Trump.
Kilgrave, but not anywhere near as funny or delightful.
Handsome.
He's on the editing room floor, man.
Yeah. You know what?
We don't want to watch
that guy. You're a hardcore feminist. You call yourself a hardcore feminist. You're very, very open about that.
Sure.
I'm curious, what does feminism mean to you? How do you define feminism?
For me, it's about being equal. I mean, it's really simple as that. And the discovery that we weren't, that we're second-class citizens, was devastating to me. And I don't believe that we're superior. I don't believe that we are entitled to anything that anyone else isn't. But we need to be equal. And the fact that we're not is just so, Jesus Christ, what world are we in? But it's, you know, you're constantly being reminded of that lack of equality, sort of at every front, particularly with this president. So that's it's not that radical.
Yeah.
Like, just pay us the same.
Yeah.
You know, respect our boundaries in the same way you respect dudes. And it's, you know, it shouldn't be. I don't think it's radical.
It's not a big ask.
It's really not a big ask, you know.
How much of your creative work is driven by this need to make sure that what you're just saying right now, this is not a big deal. Like, all we're asking for is equality, equal pay, equal opportunity. It's not a lot. How much of your creative work is propelled by that very simple notion that seems to not be getting through to people?
Not directly fueled, but you know, one thing I realized when I was doing the little Twilight tour, and there would be these autograph signing line or something like that, right? Which is like, a writer, do you know what I do? but these young girls would come up just, you know, they're 12, 13, 14. they're utterly impressionable. They are unformed, and they are being formed right now, as I was at their age, by whatever was happening in the media and around me and my family and parents. And I became wildly aware of that, but after the first movie, because I wasn't paying attention to it in the first movie. All I knew was I needed a character who was proactive and, you know, sort of just trying to bring some strength to her. And when I started meeting these young fans, I was like, holy shit, what message did I put out there? What did I do? You know, does that
suddenly the responsibility
is
like you
huge.
Can feel it. Yeah.
You can feel it, and it was terrifying. And so from that moment on, I became very conscious. I mean, still, obviously, the story and the characters are what's driving any story. But I've become more and more conscious over the years of what are people seeing. And I think that's something that we as writers don't always pay attention to. You know, we don't realize that people are going to see this. You know, we're so in our own little worlds, and it's between us and the page or us and the actor.
Right.
And, you know, Twilight was such an amazing education to really understand
the impact,
Global
impact.
Global impact.
Yeah.
And that, you know, there are little girls everywhere, and boys and women watching this, but they're being shaped by this stuff. Mm. And
do you feel that burden? Like even now, do you?
Yes,
do you
absolutely.
Sense it?
Absolutely. You know, in everything right now, in this moment, anything that's I'm always like super conscious of, of that. And I wish I was a much more articulate, well-read feminist like my sister-in-law, Mimi, but who was the first one who helped me get into Breaking Dawn. So I just kind of blunder through and try to be conscious of it.
Mm-hmm. Of course, now we're living in the post-Me Too era. Is that how we refer to it now?
I don't know.
I'm more
like my sister-in-law on the phone.
Yeah, ask Mimi. And I just wonder, you know, there's so many conversations, obviously, now that have belatedly come from this sort of new moment. But I'm curious whether you personally, in the writer's room, in the studio, you know, on the set, like, do you notice a perceptible shift in the way that this business is being run now? Or is it just kind of business as usual and people
well, it
are
is
a little
for
bit
me.
More careful?
I mean, it's business as usual for me. You know, I've always...
You're in the hashtag me already.
I love that. Yes, that's exactly right. Can I coin that?
Yeah, we'll write that down.
Okay. It's interesting. I mean, it's interesting to watch the industry be kind of buffeted about and trying to find their way into this. It's been an extraordinary experience as because there's a lot of I needed to be woke as well, because I'm of the generation we had spent our careers saying we just have to figure out how to bob and weave,
play the game.
Just get to the next job.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was always like, oh, that's just how it is. And when these incredibly brave women came forward, it was like, wake up, lady, that experience that you had back in, you know, when you were an assistant at wherever, that was not good. That was a harassment. Mm-hmm. And at the time, you just go, you know, he's the boss or whatever. We just...
Yeah,
just
it's what
get
I gotta
the
do
hands off you and
to
move
get
forward.
To the next job and to move up, just take it with a grin and move on. Yeah.
So in retrospect, it was interesting. I had, you know, myself and my friends, we'd be talking, and you know, one would tell me a story. I've known like some of my best friends I've known for 25 years. Never heard that story, and she'd say this experience of hers, and she just had never even raised it because. It's the way it is. And I was having those stories of my own, of like, I never even talked about this, was this the way it is. Mm. So it was re-traumatizing for all of us, you know, and I've had actual moments of PTSD of, you know, taking a shower and suddenly I'd be in a different place. And I never noticed, I never had that before, you know, or at least not that I was able to realize. And it was it got re-traumatized when Kavanaugh, the whole Kavanaugh hearings as well. But it was really important. And every conversation I had with friends were like, oh my God, I had no idea. You know, I've been doing this for this long and excusing that and saying, hey, that's just the way it is. You know?
So then maybe what's changed is less anything about the way that business is run in this town, and more a sort of consensus about what is and what is not okay. That, in other words, that we, by bringing this out into the open, by being comfortable sharing stories, things that you were saying, you've known these people for years and this happened to them many years ago, they never even brought it up. You yourself have had experiences that probably at the time you never, I mean, you probably thought it was shitty, but you never went any further than that. And now that there is this sort of freedom to say, that shit won't stand anymore. Right? I mean, that seems
big enough.
I would
say freedom is, we're still a ways off from freedom. Mm-hmm. It's still, you know, it's still terrifying. So interesting was, a friend of mine who's a journalist called to ask me, did I have any stories? And of course, you know, which one? But she was for Variety, I think it was, or Hollywood Reporter, I don't know. And so I told a story of an experience I'd had. It wasn't naming names.
Sharing that story? Or?
Sure, yeah. It was right when I was an assistant. I was working for Bonnie Dore, who is a mentor and was. And there was we were all at a studio. I won't name that one, but all I have to do is look at Bonnie Dore and you know it's Orion, okay? Right. So I'm an assistant at Orion, and one of the executives of Orion was a very handsy and fun guy.
That guy.
You know, yeah. And he wasn't, I enjoyed him to some degree. He was a fun guy, but it was very handsy. And at one point, his assistant, who was a friend, we were all in the same hall, came to me and she said, I'm suing him for sexual harassment. And I was like, there's a name that someone's doing that? And I didn't.
That's a thing?
That's a thing, yeah, exactly. And she asked if I would testify on her behalf, because I had obviously, you know, could totally testify on her behalf, although we probably had different experiences. But I didn't know what to do, so I went to Bonnie and I told her the story. And she said, absolutely do whatever feels right to you, but you might not be able to work again. And she was absolutely telling the truth. And not she would fire me, obviously, but that it might hurt my career. So, because I was just starting out, and I took her advice, and I didn't testify, and that woman never, that I know of, ever worked in this town again. I've carried that shame and that guilt for 20 years, 25 years of really, I betrayed a sister. But I was an assistant, and Bonnie was absolutely right. It would have fucked my career. I would not be here. I'd have done something else. And that was what it was then. It was absolutely, that was the way it was then. And so, you know, people wonder why women don't come forward. That's why. It will absolutely end their career. Yeah. So I was telling that story to my friend, and it was in the one of many stories in Hollywood Reporter. And after I hung up with her, I was shaking. Because it was going to be published. It was going to be out there. I didn't even say Orion. I didn't even say the guy's name. I said nothing. But it was the teeniest little story compared to what these other women are coming forward with. And I could at that moment really experience my awe of these women. Their courage was overwhelming. That it took this much for me to say, like, literally my article is that big. So,
and yet it still caused you so much anxiety.
So
20 years later, when nobody is firing you from anything.
Right. Well,
I'm the same way. I just,
just
in case,
you
never know.
Show. Yeah. So it was interesting.
Yeah. I wonder if the answer is that we just need more women behind the camera, that we need more women in the studio, that we need more women executives, that, I mean, obviously, you know, for generations, we've had very strong women in front of the camera. For generations, we've had incredible, strong women writing the words. We've had a slew of women, directors and producers. But then when you start talking about studio execs, people who run studios, suddenly the percentages start to come down. And let's face it, they're the ones who decide what gets made and what doesn't get made. And this conversation that I'm sure you've had so many times in your life, and I've had similar conversations with people, with female creatives in Hollywood who tell me this all the time, that, you know, you pitch a story and the heart of the story is this strong, powerful woman. And what does the exec say?
Is she likable?
Is she likable?
Is she pretty? Is she, yeah.
Will anyone in China watch it? You know, like, but I mean, can she carry a tent pole though? Right. You know, I want like six movies. Yeah. I don't know if that's the case.
I hope that's changing, but I would actually disagree with you on the behind the camera. Directors, female directors are still, what, 11% of writers, of a director in TV, and I think even much smaller when it comes to features, and I think in the Writers Guild, we're about 28%, you know, so it's still, and if you look at all the work Gina Davis has done with, you know, women in media, and, you know, the stats of women who are actually carrying movies, it's pretty much all the way around. It's, again, just make it equal.
This, by the way, is a good time to mention that every single episode of season two of Jessica Jones was directed by a woman. So well done. Yeah, absolutely. So we hear this refrain constantly from studios, from execs about, you know, what female-led films can and cannot do. I'm going to read something to you here. This is actual math. From 2014 to 2017, female-led films outperformed male-led equivalents at every single budget level.
Wow.
Okay? So the combined total for those years, $1.26 billion for female-led films, $1.04 billion for male-led films. So that's about a $224 million difference.
Cool.
So why are we still talking about this? Why are we still talking about whether, you know, people will like the female protagonist or whether it'll do well in the foreign market? I mean, we've already answered that question. We have the information. Where is this coming from? Is it just the fact that once you start getting to the highest echelons of those decision makers, of those gatekeepers, they're all just white men?
Well, yes and no. I mean, but they're all white men trying to appease their stockholders. They're all, you know, trying to, it's all about money and what makes money. And in the past, what's been making money is movies for 13-year-old boys. That started to change. I mean, I think, I don't know if Twilight was the forerunner on that, but it certainly was in that.
Had a big part to do with it,
Where suddenly it was like, wow, if you make a movie that women and girls want to see, they will see it. 10 times. They will buy the DVD. They will buy it online. Right. You know, I mean, and it was kind of like, oh, wow, I guess there is an audience. There's always been an audience, but there was nothing for them to see and nothing for them to rally around. And, you know, then after that was the Hunger Games from there on. And I think it's at the same time, 13-year-old boys started staying home and being on their video games. So I think that's been shifting a lot.
I hope so.
But I remember like being in a car with a producer down at the Austin Film Festival. We were talking about female-led movies, and this was a number of years ago. And he was like, "Women can't open a movie." I'm like, "Really? That's interesting." And he's like, "Yeah, they just can't. I mean, you know, look at Catwoman and Elektra. They tank." I'm like. Those were bad movies.
They were shitty movies.
They were shitty movies.
There's no way around that.
The billions male shitty movies. They tanked too. But, you know, because there's so few of them, the two that were made tanked. So it's like, well, you know, it's like when you work with a female writer. Well, I worked with one once and that didn't work out. I get that a lot.
If only I could think of a male-led movie that tanked. I don't know.
But I think I feel like that's shifting more.
I hope
at
so.
Least
I hope
in the
so.
Moment.
I hope so. I want to see more women running studios. I think that's when we suddenly start to see a real shift happening. Because again, you're absolutely right. The talent is there behind the camera, in front of the camera. That's been there for a very, very long time.
Yeah.
But eventually, the higher you get, eventually the person who holds the purse strings, ironically, tends to be a man and tends to be mostly a white man. Which brings us to politics. We haven't been talking about politics that much.
We have been talking about politics. All of this is politics.
All of this is politics, absolutely. Okay, we're in a very awful place. Awful is, I think, the best way that I can put it. You know, we were talking about earlier about what feminism means to you and the way in which the very word itself has undergone this transformation. We are living in a world in which 53% of white women voted for a pussy grabber. That's something that we should all probably figure out how to tackle. I don't know. As a white woman, maybe you have an opinion on it. Do you have any way to explain this other than just rank racism? I honestly don't know what to say. I don't know what to say.
I had my awakening into feminism. I get it. Because like my mother was a feminist, and so by the time I was a young woman, I believed that I could be president. She'd won the battle. She won it. That was it. So I had all, you know, feminism was an old concept, and I was an idiot. I just, you know, I didn't know anything. And I you know, even said, I'm a chauvinist. I was really stupid. But I went to college and actually did a term out in London, and I was living, staying with a feminist playwright. Just is in the background, you know, I'm reading her work, I'm seeing some stuff, and so I'm sort of subtly being influenced a little bit. And then I go to Knightsbridge, and I'm a young woman, and I go into this cafe to order breakfast. I'm at the counter, and these guys come up from behind me. They seem to be drunk already, and it's like 10 in the morning, and they're flirting, I think. And I do what I always do, is I try to smile, make nice, and like bob and weave, you know? And that was the wrong tact, because that just encouraged them, as it often does. And I tried to continue ordering my breakfast, and then one of them came up behind me, and he put his chin on my shoulder. And it wasn't, I've had guys do much worse than that, but it was, there's just something about the timing and where I had been and the information that was in my head that everything exploded. It was like a supernova, just poof. And I felt like suddenly I was connected to every woman in the history of the world. It just kind of went back. It was like that sort of explosion of like, oh, I'm a second class citizen. He feels that he is entitled to do that. I am there for him to put a chin rest for him. And it was, I began to cry. I was so angry. And then I was angry that all I could do was cry. And I realized at that point that no wonder I was denying that the movement, we weren't there yet. No wonder, because it is so horrible to feel that. It's a horrible feeling to feel less than, not worth as much, to feel like an object. It was so horrible. And I understand why any woman would not want to feel that. But it's the truth. That is the truth. So these are just women who can't feel that, who don't want to. And I understand why they don't want to. These are women who are so aggressively not wanting to feel it that they're putting that fuckhead in the White House. But, you know.
What do we do? How do we reach them? How do we break through that shell?
I don't know. I think what we do, you know, telling stories about women expanding their experience, bringing them into other people's experiences. I mean, that's what we can do. Mm-hmm. I mean, you could run for president tomorrow. I'd vote for you.
I wasn't born here, so I can't really do that. Yeah.
Governor?
Yeah.
I don't know. Anyway. But
I think I love this. I love the idea of like a brown Iranian Muslim guy running for president. That seems like a total winner. Let's do that.
Vote for you. That's a heartbeat. But I mean, I think that's what we as storytellers can do. Yeah. And that is the importance of storytelling. Is to bring people into to have them experience how other people live. And hopefully that will be a reflection and they'll feel something mm-hmm. themselves.
Okay, so Melissa, as you know, we like to end our episodes with what we call the five questions. So here we go. Question number one, what's your favorite book?
There are too many. I can't name one, but I can say anything by Margaret Atwood.
Oh, yeah?
Anything by Alice Hoffman. Anything by Jane Austen. Anything by Barbara Kingsolver or John Irving.
Those are good.
I mean...
Good. What's your favorite John Irving book?
It may be Hotel New Hampshire.
That's a good one.
Yeah.
Prayer for Owen Meany.
Yeah, that's a
tight... I'm a spiritual guy, you know.
Oh, it's such a wonderful... Yeah, that's a tight...
By the way, we, weirdly enough, talked about Alice Hoffman just last night.
Did you?
Yeah, and I quoted one of my favorite lines from her, which is, every fairy tale has a bloody lining. Every fairy tale has teeth and claws.
Oh, my God.
Mm. She's so fucking awesome.
I love okay. it. I know. It's amazing. I've loved her for decades, and the fact that I now get to adapt
so
one of her
cool.
novels is
so
just,
cool.
like, mind-blowing.
Okay, number two. What's your writing process?
I get up, work out sometimes, work out.
Good.
Make my way to the computer around 10 or 11, 11. And I have to trick myself to write, into the writing. Because, you know, the minute you sit down at the computer, the demons are all there.
Yeah.
You're a hack, you're going to fail, you have no stories to tell. So you go in and I trick them. And I start by, you know, answering emails and like maybe going doing a little online window shopping and such. But the first thing I do though is I open the document. So it's on my computer. And then I go do the window shopping and such like that. And then it's like, and then I just turn the document on. I just start writing and I'm like, oh, and now I'm just like in it, you know? And it just, it's a very long process to actually get in it. And
you know, I love how you have to sneak your way
I
into
have to
it.
Sneak my
like,
way into it.
No one's looking. I'm
no
gonna
one's
do some
looking.
Writing now.
It's true. And you know, you're not supposed to sit for 4 hours at a time. You're supposed to like get up and I'm afraid to get up and you know, I even to go to the bathroom or get lunch or whatever because if I get up I have to start the process all
yeah.
over again.
Mm-hmm.
And get past the demons and go through the whole thing. So it's that's works for me.
I love it. Number three, if you weren't a writer, what would you be?
Choreographer. That would be my dream job, of course. Local politician.
Local, like
yeah.
as in like
councilman,
city council,
something like that. Wow. Yeah, councilman. Yeah, something like that. I would have, I think, gone into law if I had. I have a reading disability, and so I could never have gone through law school if in that way. But I've always been very drawn to. I had the experience of being. On the board of the directors at the Writers Guild. I had experience of
right.
being president of student council at my college. And I had the experience of affecting change. And it is addictive. When you actually can, there's a person you helped. That sense of power is really a rush. I like it. I like affecting change. And there's so much, I'm a perfectionist, so much that's like, annoys me.
That's amazing.
I would like to change things.
By the way, you were my strike captain. You don't even know
what?
That. What? You don't even know that.
There you go.
What's the worst writing advice that you've ever been given?
Not really. It's not really advice as much as an attitude.
Mm.
And the sort of ingrained thought was the work, it's all about the work. The work is enough. And so basically you can be whoever you are, but what ends up on the page is what matters. It isn't. It's so much about being someone people want to work with and collaboration.
Right.
I mean, in our business, you know, if you don't have that, then go be a novelist or, you know, something else. But it's, that took me a long time to figure out. I was just like, oh, you know, your ideas suck. These are better. And ultimately, it doesn't matter that I'm telling you your ideas suck because what I put on the page, no.
Hmm.
Like, don't be someone who tells someone their ideas suck. You know? oddly, that took me a really long time to figure out, which is sad. But.
And then finally, what is the best advice that you can give to a writer who's just starting or an emerging writer?
It's all about tenacity. If you know, this is a tough business, and you know, you get your teeth kicked in on any given moment, and you're lying there bleeding on the floor, and you have to pick yourself up. And the difference between someone who's made it, who's working and making money at it and being able to express themselves, and the person who leaves the industry is exactly that. Can you pick yourself up? And my solution for that is delusional optimism. You're on the floor bleeding, and you just tell yourself it's going to be better tomorrow. It won't. It really won't. And it probably won't be the next day either, but eventually it's going to be better. And if you can just, I know it's a very sort of, you know, the sun will come up tomorrow, but you have to kind of, that's where it is. You can't, you know, wallow as long as you want, but eventually pick yourself the hell up.
Keep going.
And then, you know, never ends.
And here we are now. At the end of your journey, although that seems weird, right? At the end of your journey.
Oh, like, what's in this thing?
I wanted to tell you, you're dying tomorrow.
Oh, no. Jesus.
No, at the present of your journey, you have your own production company, Tall Girls, and that's the whole point, right? The whole point is to focus your time, your energy, your resources on making sure that stories about women, about empowered women, about women who break the stereotypes that we're so familiar with, women who can be whatever they want to be on screen, whether it's film or television, that there is a place for that.
That's actually my secondary goal. My first goal is utterly narcissistic.
Tell good stories?
I want to tell good stories. I want people to...
That's what a writer says.
I want to say what my experience is. I want people to have to listen to what my story is. And my story is everyone's story.
Yeah, good. Yeah. Well, I have been following your story for a long time, and I can't wait to just keep following it. I'm so, so glad that I got a chance to talk to you. Melissa Rosenberg, everybody. Thank you, thank you, thank you to my guest, Melissa Rosenberg. If you want to follow her, her socials are @tallgirlmel. Tall Girl M-E-L. Thank you for joining us for another episode of Rough Draft. We'll see you next time. Rough Draft is a Topic original series hosted by me, Reza Aslan. Executive produced by Reza Aslan, David Andreoni, Alfredo De Villa, and Safa Samizadeh Yazd. Executive producers for Topic are Ryan Chanatry, Anna Holmes, and Gina Constantinakos, with production aid from Russell Sperberg. Our music and theme is by Jacob Snyder, sound by Sean Oakley, editing and mixing by Will Stanton, with additional editing by Blake V. You can follow Rough Draft on Twitter @RoughDraftReza, on Facebook @RoughDraftWithRezaAslan, or you can email us at roughdraftpodcast@topic.com. You can also follow me, Reza Aslan, @Reza Aslan. For transcripts and a list of full credits, go to topic.com/rdpodcast. If you love this interview, be sure to check out our TV show, as well as Topic's original series and exclusive programming from around the world. Try it for free on the Apple TV app, already on your favorite devices. You can watch Topic at home or on the go with offline viewing, and you can also share your subscription between up to 6 family members with family sharing. That's what I do. Go to apple.co/topic, that's apple.co/topic, to start your 7-day free trial now. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time on Rough Draft.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.